So for those of you tuning in, thank you for your patronage. You are listening to what's going to be another episode, a complete topic change. In the words of Bill O'Reilly, blanket, we're doing it live. I made that joke 2 hours ago, and I'm going to make it again because I can. Not as funny as Rex's flipper joke, but...
Yeah, I mean, but, and you know, I'm not going to criticize you for making a joke because it was pretty good. I appreciate it.
I enjoyed that one.
I think jokes get funnier after you retell them a couple times, to be honest with you.
Well,
because there's something funny in telling the same lame joke more than once.
That's the meta-analysis of jokes.
Mm-hmm. But yeah, thank you and welcome back to Alternative Lies.
I mean, I think for those
live broadcast.
Yeah, I mean, if you're listening from the hopeful eventual upload, which is now going to be recorded, we hope, this would theoretically be episode 4.
Mm-hmm.
We just covered in the last couple hours an overview of all of the Trump-Russia connections.
Might break that one into two parts, to be honest with you. It was pretty in-depth and pretty substantial.
Yeah, we were talking there for a little over 2 hours about all of the Trump and Russia connections leading up to November 8th, 2016.
A lot to cover.
Definitely a lot to cover, and there's still a lot more that we didn't that we're probably not going to do because Robert Mueller is on the case.
In this episode of Alternative Lies, we're going to cover climate change and climate change denialism.
And this is something that I think at least the two of us, both me and Rex here, we acknowledge the fact that the scientific consensus is climate change is real.
Yeah.
And it's not only real, but it is bearing down upon us at an uncomfortable pace. And we have 12 years to stop it or do something about it or at least mitigate its effects before we get
irreversible damage.
And some scientists would even argue that we're already too late, that we're already on a runaway course towards climate change becoming a problem that we can't control.
Mm-hmm. And yeah, I'm firmly rooted in science. I am myself a scientist, and I know that you are very much the same in that regard. And so you're getting perspective here from two people who have spent
years in science, even though we're
going through and
relatively young.
Yeah, I mean, I have an undergraduate degree in chemistry and I've been working in the industry for the last several years. And so it's something that, you know, the scientific method and what you determine by applying it is very real and it's very firmly rooted in reality, but a lot of individuals don't necessarily
have that full understanding.
Yeah. I don't think they have the full understanding, but I think there's some misinformation there that has persuaded them to think other things, which aren't true.
Yeah, to say the least. And I mean, I think it's important that we make the point that you don't necessarily need a degree in a scientific field to understand the fact that climate change is a very real problem and that you should want to do something about it and to vote for people who also want to do something about it.
Yep.
And I think that's hopefully the intent of our episode is to try and communicate sort of a layperson's understanding or sort of summarize what the scientific community has compiled about climate change and
cover some of the common rumors or the...
Yes, and then trying to address some of the myths.
Yes.
Of course, inevitably cover the president's tweets about climate change and trying to debunk the political portions of climate change denialism as well.
Yep. I mean, all you really need to do is drop a big ice cube in the ocean.
Well, I mean, at that rate, Florida's going to be underwater a lot quicker because it'll melt.
Yeah, I guess you're right. But then it'll
make
cool. Yeah.
It'll dilute out the acidified oceans.
That would make
it less acidic.
Everything better.
Are you hear that? Giant ice cube 2020. Let's do it.
Vote for me.
I'll put that as a bumper sticker on my car. Giant ice cube.
I feel like I'm taking crazy pills.
I see you found the soundboard.
Uh-huh. Yeah, we're right. But the thing is you hear something like that and you go, what is happening? You know, you feel like you're going insane.
Yeah.
So I feel like it makes sense there.
Yeah. Well, since we have the soundboard, now we're going to start hitting all these buttons here. we're going to make this
hopefully
the
not too frequently.
No, here's actually I want to start using this one anytime we change topics. This is a pretty recognizable sound. That's the Batman transition.
Yeah,
I like that a lot.
Pretty fun transition.
So, what I've got pulled up in front of me, and people who are probably climate change deniers are just going to start tuning out right now.
Which is fine.
Again, we're not really trying to reach out to those folks.
Well, and to be honest with you, you're not going to be able to change people's minds.
Yeah, when they're that staunchly attached to either conspiracy theories or denialism or combinations of both, that trying to confront them with facts and knowledge has the opposite effect. It makes them double down and become more staunch and hardened in their beliefs.
And I wouldn't suggest that we're trying to preach to the choir either here. I think what we're trying to do is reach out to individuals who might not be
fully aware of fully the aware scope of what's
or,
going on.
You know, have one strong opinion one way or the other,
right,
and to kind of inform you so you can make your own decision about
right
how, what climate change is
and what you want to do about it.
I would hope that you would make the educated decision and come to the conclusion that it's a real problem. But
yeah. So with that being said, what I've got pulled up in front of me is climate.nasa.gov, and it's literally just a website that compiles the scientific consensus of 18 different scientific associations, and I'll pick out a few choice ones. I'll read off probably the name of every organization on here, and then I'll pick a couple of statements from maybe like two or three of them just to show you the how broad the scientific consensus actually is, despite what you might hear in media reports about, you know, people being unsure or having evidence
or disagreeing
to the contrary
or something like that. Yeah,
we have the American Association for Advancement of Science, American Chemical Society, American Geophysical Union, American Medical Association, American Meteorological Society, American Physical Society, which is physics based, Geological Society of America. We have U.S. National Academy of Sciences. We have International Academy of Sciences Joint Statements, the U.S. Global Change Research Program, which has been in operation for the last 50 years, which is a U.S. government agency, Intergovernmental Body, which is the Panel on Climate Change. There are 200 worldwide scientific organizations that have established that their position is that climate change has been caused by human action. Multiple agencies of the government, despite Donald Trump being the president and the Republicans being in control, have also agreed with that consensus.
Just recently, I think maybe 3 weeks ago, they put out a pretty sweeping report came to the conclusion.
Yeah, this was on November 27th.
Due to man-made actions, there has been drastic changes in the climate.
Yeah, this is actually a report issued by the Trump administration.
Yes, put out by the Trump administration.
Yeah, the 1,600-page National Climate Assessment. And the report notes that in a worst-case scenario, top scientists from 13 federal agencies say that climate change primarily is caused by human activity, could deliver a 10% hit to the nation's GDP by the end of this century.
Well, and it already has had a devastating effect on the economy worldwide and the U.S. economy.
Yeah, I mean, think about it, right? All of the hurricanes we get every hurricane season, how we see states like
Harvey, the several hurricanes that hit Puerto Rico,
Maria.
Just recently the ones that hit Florida.
Yeah,
I mean, you can't even keep track of them
because they go through the alphabet practically naming hurricanes over and over every hurricane season, which happens every year. I mean, those states on the Atlantic coast just get pummeled, and in the Gulf
hammered.
Of Mexico too.
And every time you have a hurricane come through, you know, not only you have the cost of rebuilding, but you have all of the costs associated with no businesses being patronized during that time, and the fact that people after a disaster are not spending money, or, you know, they're not able to get to work and work. I mean, just a lot of ripple effects that, that kind of cascade down into a community.
Absolutely. Well, and like you said, you know, the cost of rebuilding, the cost of lost productivity and time for people impacted by natural disasters, which have been made worse by climate change.
Or you may not be able to get your goods that you would generally ship overseas out because you've had, I don't know. For instance, Samsung had a memory factory that was flooded. They made flash memory, and this was a couple of years ago that was flooded and completely took the factory offline. Ended up spiking the cost of SSDs, so solid-state hard drives, like almost, I don't know, like 70 or 80%.
Yeah, well, and I mean, I like that you brought up the fact that you know, there was a tangible economic good whose sale essentially was affected by the product of a natural disaster. And that kind of got me remembering. And this is even all the way back as far as 2014. And this was from the United Nations Intergovernmental Panel on Climate Change. But there are crops that we all, you know, either we being societies, farmers grow it, and a lot of their livelihood and their the money that comes in to sustain the operation is based off of the return on their harvests.
Yes.
There's a lot of crops that are going to be a lot more difficult to grow because of warming temperatures in some regions. And everyone's favorite food to make fun of, avocados. That's number one on this list here.
Making the millennials bankrupt. But
exactly.
We might not have to worry about it because in the very near future, they might be almost impossible to grow in the climate that we have.
Yep. And that is because of drought and heat in California could threaten a lot of avocado groves. And in that same vein, almonds, they require, almond trees require a lot of water and stretches
almonds,
of temperature.
Pistachios, all sorts of nuts. They're just really water thirsty.
And what is it? Long stretches of winter temperatures below 45 degrees Fahrenheit to spur blossoms and bud in the spring. Hmm. And at least according to this report from this panel, a lot of regions in California barely get that cold as it is. And any warming is just going to shut down a lot of orchards for good. Grapes. Summer temperatures getting really hot can more or less shrivel up grapes, so they just lose a lot of it. That affects
kill the harvest.
Winemaking too, because obviously you need grapes for that. Milk, because the cows get overheated, so you can't really.
That's one you don't really think about. It's pretty obvious with all the crops that are just water thirsty, but you know.
Yeah. The optimum temperature for milk production is 40 to 70 degrees Fahrenheit, and dairy farmers can't afford to run AC constantly to cool down cows. Now that's a lot of
expense. I mean, they put a lot of body heat out themselves.
Yeah,
so,
they're big animals. And then trees that harbor other fruits like apples and cherries, a lot of them, and this is, I think, going to tie into a common myth about climate change. A lot of fruit trees, because of more extreme colder weather, have, some of these other fruit trees have been very vulnerable to frost.
Yeah.
And that's one of the big myths about climate change is that, it's cold outside, therefore it's not a problem.
Yeah, I think these people get the impression that just because it's called global warming, that it's just affecting the overall temperature, that the average temperature of the climate is getting warmer, which is true.
Right.
But it also affects the climate in a lot of different ways and causes things to, like Marcus has mentioned, in certain areas be colder or to have more severe snowstorms or blizzards
or hurricanes
and just in general causes the weather patterns to shift in a way that is dramatically different than the historical weather patterns have been.
Right. And our scientific agencies have been collecting data on this for decades, if not longer. And I think they even have the ability to extrapolate backwards in time to, times where we weren't even able to record these data to interpret what the weather may have been like then, based on, like you mentioned earlier, good scientific method and
sedimentary levels of soil and all sorts of stuff like that.
There's a lot of different sort of either like surrogate markers or just methodologies that scientists can take to sort of make that assessment. And I think the fact that this consensus is so strong across all these different government agencies and has been for quite a while indicates that the methods our scientists are using to go about assessing whether climate change is a problem or not, or at least have been validated, repeated, and proven sound. And I think that's one of the core issues at the crux of climate change being important to the everyday person, right? Is, all these scientists in an ivory tower, how does that affect me?
Yeah.
Well, I mean, from what we talked about here, it's just as far as,
buying
fruit,
a lot of your goods. Yeah,
buying
your
goods. Yeah, you can't. If you can buy it, it's going to be a lot more expensive because the farmers need to recoup their losses, that they're losing crops and they're losing time because of the effect of climate change.
Another big one is for any of our listeners out there who happen to enjoy the coastal areas of this planet or have lived on the coast, you're going to see ocean levels rising and a lot of land that's going to be just disappearing due to the rising ocean levels. Hawaii, for instance, is expected to be losing ground quite rapidly over the next century or two.
Yeah, let me see. Yeah, it's just after a hurricane in Hawaii, there was a small island that vanished underwater.
Yeah.
And, I mean, it was a remote island, but the fact that you have an entire island that just sinks because a hurricane came along that was powerful enough to make that happen.
A lot of the tolls out there are literally just a beach. I mean, that's how much land there is already. It's just a beach. There's no extra land there to give up, And and in a lot of those small islands or tolls out in the Pacific will just disappear.
Yeah. Well, and this article I have pulled up describing that event. Now, there was a climate scientist who said this is a holy crap, not in that terminology, moment for him, because he said the probability of occurrences like this will go up the longer climate change is allowed to go undeterred, basically. And another point that the scientist makes is the fact that, at least in regards to this specific little atoll or remote Hawaiian island, it was home to seals and turtles. That was a habitat for them. And
right.
Now that this is underwater, you've displaced a lot of animals from their habitat.
Yeah.
And I think the point that I want to make is the fact that events like this can have a lot of effects on the sort of ecology of things. The fact that animals and possible entire food chains and things like that are being negatively affected are just unreal.
It's a huge shift. And, I guess you could make the argument that, seals and turtles, they're not that big of a deal. But, you're going to see a lot of loss of biodiversity caused because of these natural events that are happening. And when you lack biodiversity in things, you start to have this failure in the chain or the order of things, as you would say. Like if you no longer have bees, then you can't pollinate all of your crops. And if you can't pollinate your crops, you can't grow your crops, which is another thing. Like bees in particular, not only are they being, hit by this really nasty, blight, that's kind of this disease that people haven't really figured out, or scientists haven't really figured out how to solve yet.
Right.
But they're sensitive to the environment. And when they start to see warmer temperatures, they might not be able to survive as easily. And that's a massive thing. I mean, you can't pollinate an entire crop by hand. I mean, there's some instances where people do, some hand pollination stuff, but we need insects and bees and bugs and stuff to be in the ecosystem. And when you lose these things, you take a serious hit to, it's like a waterfall comes down on you. It's like one drop isn't a big deal. Mm-hmm. But as soon as you start to get more water in that waterfall, it really will start to damage you. And we're the ones that will eventually feel the ultimate effects of that problem.
Yeah, I think now that we addressed the portion about Hawaii, right? And we talked about that, that biodiversity. And as you mentioned too, the pollination issue, that's not isolated to any one particular area of the geographical U.S. Mm-hmm. That's pretty widespread across middle America, because you need bees to plant crops.
Yep.
Or pollinate crops. Wouldn't it be awesome if the bees could plant the crops too?
Maybe one day.
Maybe when we get those super bees.
I, for one, welcome our bee overlords.
Our crop planting bee overlords. It's like that episode of Black Mirror. Have you seen the one with the bees?
No.
I recommend it. It's equally disturbing as climate change.
Nick Cage in it screaming the bees.
I know, but I wish he was.
I'm surprised we don't have that sound effect on our little our board here.
I think the closest thing we have is the Wilhelm scream.
Yeah,
maybe. That's not right, as that dramatic
and
as Nicolas Cage.
The bees.
Yeah. Anyways, I think what I also had pulled up in addition to that discussion about Hawaii, is Florida. That's a state that, one, a lot of it's surrounded by coast. Mm-hmm. I mean, it's a more or less just an entire coastal state.
It's a peninsula.
It's a peninsula. And the fact of the matter is, a lot of the industry, one, is driven by tourism. People go to Florida all the time to either
for the beaches,
to visit the beach, to party
for the
beach, for the weather, to retire there.
Yep.
There's a substantial portion of retirees in Florida. And really what it boils down to with climate change is the fact that a lot of Florida is going to be underwater in the coming decades. And here are some quotes by climate scientists as early as May this year. In the past century, the sea has risen 9 inches in Key West. In the past 23 years, it's risen by 3 inches. By 2060, it's predicted to rise 2 feet, with another sign of slowing
down.
2 feet.
I mean, imagine that. A lot of these beachfront properties are literally built on the beach.
Yeah.
I mean, you lose 2 feet of your coastal area, and not only are you just going to have that area which was once land underwater, mm-hmm. but you're going to have a lot of erosion associated with that, where if your house is offset from the beach, maybe 10, 15, 20 feet, you're going to see a lot of erosion, and it's going to start eating away at your backyard and maybe eventually even your house.
Right. Just imagine, for anyone listening, I want you, where you're sitting right now, imagine you know, measure 2 feet upwards of your height, basically.
Mm-hmm.
And now imagine everything below that 2 foot mark, you know, on your body is immersed in water.
Yeah.
And that's going to be the default.
It's quite a bit. And that's 2060. You know, that's really honestly not that far off.
I mean, it's going to happen in our lifetime.
Easily.
So,
yeah. I mean,
for two under 30 and dudes. Yeah.
An exceptional, you know, almost, you know, it takes off. It's
exponential.
Exponential. Yeah. Thank you. It'll take off. And it's by 2060, you might have 2 feet sea level rise. But by 2070, we might see 5 feet, you know. Because
yeah.
they're just going to compound further and further, which relates to the greenhouse gases and the warming of the overall
climate. Yeah, I mean, you
climate.
Get you know, ice melting, sea levels rising, acidification of the coral or of the ocean.
Ocean,
and that,
yeah.
You know, negatively affecting the coral.
And it's all due in part to the use of fossil fuels, which we've been
greenhouse gas emissions.
Unlocking all of the CO2 that was at one point stored in the Earth's crust.
Right. I mean, this kind of gets into the political portion of it. You know, there at this point in the game where we are, there seems to be two opposing forces here.
Mm-hmm.
One being the scientific community and, you know, statistically speaking, a good-sized majority of the American public who, one, agree that, yes, it's a man-made problem, and two, want to see concrete action taken in both policy and in their communities to try and combat some of this. And a lot of that's going to be relative to where these folks live, whether they're, you know, on a coastal state like Florida, whether they're in, you know, middle America trying to recover.
Grow from, crops.
Yeah,
yeah.
Their failed crops.
Or
yields,
tornadoes. Yeah.
Or, yeah, I mean, tornadoes, that's another good one.
Or if you're in a forested area, for instance, like Paradise, I mean, the wildfire that we had there just recently, the campfire,
yeah,
devastated that city and killed quite a few people. I think it was almost upwards of 80 people that were killed by this fire. And
yeah.
So it's really, and as a direct result was because of the warming climate, and you had a warmer environment that was more conducive to the fires, but also has partially to do with how people, I think, are living in areas which historically aren't really safe to be living. You know, this is an area that was pretty deep in the forest,
yeah.
And you know, it's one thing that you can expect in a forest,
yeah,
is a fire.
Yeah, you're living in a tinderbox.
And I mean, it's the same case with people who live on the coast in Florida or who live in New Orleans, which is,
yeah, I mean, that's Katrina,
flooding,
right?
You know, and I think it's just historically where people have wanted to live are,
yeah,
also places that are prone to natural,
yeah,
disasters.
I mean, part of that, you know, it's the assumed risk you take on when you live in one of those areas, right? But
you can certainly mitigate that assumed risk.
Yes, exactly.
And lower it significantly by changing your climate.
Yeah, well, and trying to, you know, like you alluded to, reducing greenhouse gas emissions and trying to shift our sources of energy from fossil fuels to, mm-hmm, renewable green energy, you know, solar, air, wind, electric. And
which ultimately all comes from the sun.
Right. I mean, basically, we're harnessing the giant ball of fire in the sky rather,
right,
than burning things on the surface of the earth.
Which is where the fossil fuels came from originally as well. You know,
yeah,
I mean, it was like for millions of years, there was no bacteria that existed that could break down the wood from plants.
Yeah.
And so it just stacked up and piled up and eventually got buried underneath the earth, right?
Yeah.
And now all of that carbon that had at one point been trees or plant matter,
yeah,
is now being
organic matter
dug out of the ground,
yeah,
and used, you know, for its convenience or,
right,
for the money it brings you because you can
sell it by the barrel.
It. Yeah, sell it by the barrel or run a giant power plant and power the lights.
Yeah. Oh. Thank you.
Next up.
Next up. I think the where we wanted to go from there, and really we just wanted to get a general sense of, you know, how climate change affects the common person, right? You know, the things you buy are going to be more expensive depending on where you're living. You might be more underwater as the years go by.
Mm-hmm. In debt and also just underwater.
What's that rap song that was out recently? Young, Dumb, and Broke? Now it's going to be amended to be Young, Dumb, Broke, and Wet. Or Young, Dumb, Broke, and Overheating.
Young, Dumb, Broke, and
Young, Dumb, Broke,
Drowning.
And without crops.
Without crops. Marcus is coming at you with the remixes. I mean, he is
yeah,
DJ
a
Full
label.
Metal Racket. So
yeah, that's my DJ name, my alternative lifestyle here.
And yeah, so, how does it affect the lay person? You right. know, what, yeah. what is it going to do to you? And the answer is it's going to change a lot of things in your daily life.
Yeah, well, I mean, I know I came back here to Oregon State for school September of last year, and one of the first things that I noticed was the fact that, you know, typically, you know, I got my undergraduate here from 2011 to 2015, and September through, like, May or June was typically just kind of incessant drizzling with some harder rain mixed in, but it was, you know, kind of like the rain season, and then you had sun in the summer and rinse and repeat. Mm-hmm. But I noticed that when I came back during that time frame, it rained not nearly as much as I was used to.
Yeah, it's been a fairly dry few years.
Yeah, and I know too, my research advisor mentioned while I was in talks to come back and rejoin his lab, he mentioned that, you know, it was almost a borderline drought here.
Mm-hmm.
And yeah. for the Pacific Northwest, where everybody jokes about everyone being depressed because you never see the sun. Well, I guess we're curing depression, but it's almost like we're not seeing the rain anymore.
Yeah. Well, I mean, that's a bit anecdotal, but it is backed by overall trends and
that's the
research
trend.
By, you know, climate scientists. And things are getting drier and you're seeing a lot of these droughts, which are affecting, like Marcus said, the crop yields, for instance, in California, which has been under a state of drought for
quite a while.
I think almost like 3 or 4 years.
Yeah.
They have been drilling wells that are deeper and deeper to get lower into those aquifers.
Mm-hmm.
And when those aquifers are empty, they're empty. You know, they take hundreds and hundreds of years to fill up.
But you could probably empty them in one or two.
Yeah, exactly. You just pump thousands of gallons out of the ground. And it's not just going to fill up overnight. And once your water's gone and you're in a drought, you're not going to grow anything at all.
Yeah, you're SOL.
And California is one of the largest economies in the United States and in the world. I think their GDP is like top like 5 or 6.
Yeah, I want to say California's like 6th. Just in
size
compared to other countries.
Of their economy. Yeah, like literally it's like the United States, China, it's, you know,
no, maybe the UK,
a couple
Australia,
other company, or sorry, countries, and then it's like California,
right, India, and then California. Well, and that kind of brings me to an interesting note related to California. I did see a story the other day, reported, and let me actually try and pull up the article. And this kind of goes with some of what you were saying earlier. But I saw an article that corporations, you know, large corporations, are buying in mass the land rights to California aquifers to try and secure a source of water to cope with the advent of climate change and how serious of a problem it's becoming. Let me see if I can dig that up, because I think that went hand in hand with what you had to say about catastrophe bonds.
Oh, yeah. The catastrophe bonds are pretty interesting, and historically they've just kind of been used to mitigate risk for investors. But the premise of a catastrophe bond is that you'll sell this bond with a fairly high rate of return, but in the event of a natural disaster or large catastrophe, you won't get any return on your bond. Whereas, say, during the time period, the maturation time period of like 10 years, if there's no natural disasters, you will get the return on your money. And so, I don't know, it's a very interesting construct here, because as you see things changing globally with a lot more natural disasters hitting due to climate change,
mm-hmm.
you're going to see kind of the shift in the financial markets too, not only just from the productivity scale,
right.
but a lot of these catastrophe bonds are used to subsidize people's insurance on like flood insurance or other just homeowners insurance. And when no one buys a catastrophe bond because it's a like terrible investment, if you know you're never going to make your money back because there's guaranteed to be a horrible catastrophe due to climate change, no one's going to be mitigating the effects of this,
right.
and it's going to prevent people from being able to get the relief they need when they've been hit by this catastrophe.
And that's a very real aspect of climate change that probably isn't really talked about all that much. And I did find the stories about the California vineyards. It was actually corporations like Nestle, we had Goldman Sachs, and then the University of Harvard were all buying up California aquifers and vineyards to more or less become the water barons of the future.
Interesting.
So
that's like real Dune.
Yeah. I mean, we're going to reach a point potentially where climate change is such a drastic problem that we're going to be reaching out to corporations for them to resell us drinking water. I mean,
that's literally what Nestle already does.
Yeah, well, Nestle has drawn a lot of ire, too, for going into underdeveloped countries and more or less seizing their sources of water, bottling it, and then selling it back to them.
Yeah.
Nestle is unequivocally evil when it comes to water rights and drinking water.
Developed or not, they do that here in the United States. They literally just take water from municipalities, bottle it, and then sell it.
Yeah, I think there's...
It probably has more of a financial burden and effect for, you know, individuals who live in developing countries, but...
Yeah, well, I mean, it's happening here, too. Here's another article. Bottled water giant Nestle tells California regulators it's entitled to keep piping water. And I think the California regulators are trying to stop them from doing that because a private entity is coming and taking what most people would agree is a right. You know, drinking water, clean drinking water is a right.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, at least I'm of that opinion, and I think you are too. But I think if you pull any person off the street and ask them, are you entitled to clean drinking water? They would say, yes, I need that to stay alive, as do every other living organism for the most part.
Yeah, I am safe for like, I don't know. I can't really think of too many.
Well, I mean, I was going to say, even if you're like a tardigrade, that's something that's just some immortal, kind of you water. Still need water.
Yeah. Yeah. And it is a right. You know, we've determined that. And that's why we have publicly run water companies instead of privately owned and operated water companies.
Right.
And the interesting thing about bottling water is it's literally just something you take out of the tap and you put it in a plastic bottle and people go crazy for it. It's like,
yeah.
Doesn't make any sense at all.
It doesn't, but
and it adds
made money off of it.
Quite a bit of an extra level of emissions and just
generating more waste and
to that like source of water from all the plastic and whatnot, yeah, and packaging.
And fossil fuels have been
transporting, and water's like probably the heaviest thing you can transport in terms of like what we have in our food.
Yeah. Well, and I mean, think about it too.
There's plenty of heavy stuff to transport, but like of what you're going to eat or drink, like water is it, you know?
Yeah. Well, and in the process of trying to bottle all of that water, I mean, think of all of the fuels that's been expended to make all the plastic, to bottle it up, to transport it, and then to resell it. I mean, the concept of hoarding water, I mean, that's another contributor to climate change right there, because... You know, you're going to take a situation that you anticipate being catastrophic in the future and you're going to make it worse for the sake of being the richest person in the barren, empty wasteland where everyone's dying of thirst or drowning.
I mean, no, they're profiting off of the environment. And that's the problem, is the reason why we're hit with such horrible climate consequences is because people can profit off of this.
Right.
And they're profiting off of the oil that they take out of the ground so you can drive your car. They profit off the bottled water. There's just any number of things that make them money. And that's why I think a lot of the climate change myths and rumors have been spread in order to prevent people from thinking it's really that big of a problem, in order to prevent these companies from being able to profit on it. Because as soon as the public opinion in general becomes this is a problem, they're not going to be able to do it anymore.
Yeah, well, I mean, we should be hearing a lot of this when you hear oil companies are selling us down the river for profit.
Right. Yeah, I mean, absolutely. You should be upset about this. I mean, the most recent Secretary of the Interior, Ryan Zinke, recently announced that he would no longer be returning to the Trump administration in January.
Right.
Interesting enough, he rode in on his very first day on the back of a horse. Don't know if
you
heard about that,
but he rode in,
you know, made this speech about how he wanted to parody Teddy Roosevelt and be this, you know, force for good in terms of preserving our natural parks and whatnot.
That was a lie.
Immediately turned around and sold a lot of our land.
That was federal land.
Or leased the land, which is as good as just
selling it off. Yeah.
To oil companies so they could do offshore drilling. They could frack. Yeah. I mean, it's just like, you've got people like this who are giving our public lands away to then pollute them and to contribute more to global warming. And that's really the problem. And the root of it is that there's people who are going to benefit off of the system. And then there's everyone else who's going to suffer from it. And so it's like, what do you do? And I think that the real thing is regulation and You need to figure out a way in order to put a carbon tax on carbon emissions.
That's a good start.
Which actually has been proven to be a really successful method for controlling carbon emissions and even benefiting the economy. And a lot of people argue that the carbon tax would be detrimental to the profits of business. But there's been a number of world-renowned economists which have actually suggested otherwise and have said that the carbon tax would be a huge benefit, not only in preventing climate change, but just in a financial way, it would be a very successful thing to institute.
Yeah, let me see if I can.
Yeah, Marcus is looking up right now for me some sources on that. You know, the interesting part is that shifts investments more towards renewables, you know, for instance, solar, wind, hydroelectric, and kind of pulls us away from, you know, oil and gas because it's not as profitable as, you know, solar would be then because it would be taxed on the carbon emission.
Yeah. Well, here's your source. Yeah, Nobel Prize winning economist says carbon taxes are the solution to climate change. Paul Romer,
yep,
who was the 2018 economic sciences co-winner, and I believe this was a joint statement from him and his other co-winner, William Nordhaus, because they're work was solely dedicated to the economics of climate change.
Yes.
So, I mean, this is literally the subject of the most recent Nobel Prize in economics was of climate change and how it's going to be so detrimental to the economy. And the solution they recommend as a very good start was a carbon tax.
Yeah. And, you know, the colloquialism there is, oh, you know, I don't want to pay to anymore to drive my car around, or, you know, we deserve to be able to drive cars as Americans.
But my freedom.
Yeah, exactly. And when you oppose regulations on society and corporations, you're hindering the free market. But the argument made by these economists is that actually by imposing this carbon tax, you are benefiting the free market because it makes them more inventive of come up with more marketable solution.
Yeah, have an incentive to switch and discover new solutions. That's the quote that the economist gave in the article, right? And like they say further up in the byline, you know, they say the problem is not the fact that we don't know what to do. We know exactly what needs to be done. The problem is generating a consensus to act. Mm-hmm. And so I think this goes back to the undercurrent that I mentioned right at the start, is the fact that we, the people, need to form that consensus and put people in charge to act on it. And
because the people in charge
now,
as it stands, are
selling us
very,
out.
Very intelligent.
Very stable geniuses.
Very stable geniuses. And in fact, of the most recent climate change report that was published by the Trump administration,
yep,
Trump determined, due to his great intelligence,
high levels of intelligence,
literally claims that because he has high levels of intelligence, he found the report to be not as accurate. Or,
well, he just said, I don't believe it.
Right. Yeah.
Well, and there is so much just inherent danger or detriment to the cause of preventing climate change from ravaging the environment and ravaging our economy when you have the president of the United States spouting that kind of language. And one, I think the first point that most people are going to agree with, if they're not a devout Trump supporter, is the fact that that statement was not rooted in any scientific evidence or fact. This is Donald Trump just saying,
I don't understand it,
but I'm really smart, therefore I don't like it, and it's bad,
yep,
which is not an argument at all. And this is my response to that.
I award you no points, and may God have mercy on your soul.
Yeah.
I don't know about that God and mercy part, because I don't know if he deserves mercy.
Yeah, I think at this point, God might be running out of mercy.
Mueller is short out on mercy.
the moon waxes and his mercy wanes.
Yes.
And the president has also, he's for the longest time, has been a staunch climate change denier. You know, mm-hmm, he tweets constantly, but, you know, oh, it's cold outside and everything's fine.
I can think of probably about 12 memes that he's posted on his Twitter,
yeah,
account. I mean, maybe retweeted. I don't know.
Well, and then we were talking about the comments he made regarding the California wildfires and their droughts, about how, you know, all of that will be solved if they raked their forests like Finland.
Yeah. So he was referring to, I guess, what the Finns do to manage their forests. I'm not really certain if that's true or not, but he claimed that the Finns rake their forests in order to mitigate forest fires. And so he said that we need to be more like them. And in order to prevent forest fires, we should rake our forests.
Yeah, rake the floors of the forest.
I don't know if he means like one guy out there with like a yard rake, just kind of collecting all the pine needles and pine cones. And
yeah, just send out the Covfefe boy with a rake.
Yeah, George Papadopoulos is out there with a rake, just going to town.
Well, at the rate we're going, it's going to be a smocking rake. It's so hot, the rake is going to ignite and become smocking.
A smocking forest floor.
Very legal and very cool.
Very legal.
Anyways, the response to that completely backwards comment from the president of Finland was a quote saying, "We don't rake the forest floor, but we do other things that you should emulate."
And yeah,
a lot of that is, again, sensible climate policy that involves things like carbon taxes and renewable energy. And of course, you know, in the face of all of that, the entire country of Finland more or less just capitalize on that self-owned by Donald Trump. But
yeah, I don't know where he got that idea. I mean, I guess I don't know where he gets a lot of ideas, but yeah, some of it must just come to him. I
think what comes out of his mind and onto his Twitter feed is probably just an amalgamation of what all the people around him are saying, and then his own stupid opinion just mushed into it, and it comes out.
Yeah, I mean, maybe
rakes
like
the forest floor.
Someone 20 years ago shared one of those snail mail email chains, you know, his grandma linked him.
Mm-hmm.
And it was 10 cool things the Finns do to protect their natural environment. I don't know. And then one of them was like
a chain email.
They rake the leaves. And he was like, "Whoa, that's kind of cool." And then when these guys asked him about the forest fires in paradise, he was like, I know what to do to fix it."
Yeah, I like,
they better rake those leaves.
Yeah, I like the way this LA Times article ends. And props to author Anu Partanen. The president would like Californians to go rake in the woods like good Finns do while our planet is burning up. As far as most Finns are concerned, if we and our governments don't do far more to fight climate change, we'll all be Californians on fire. Which is not false. And that's what the scientific community more or less says, is if we don't do things both on the micro levels in terms of our communities and in terms of, you know, macro levels as far as large-scale policy.
Like, for instance, the Paris Climate Accord.
Yes, and that,
which is a big one.
And that was what Donald Trump made a giant apprentice-style skeptical of last year, I believe.
Yeah.
When he decided to withdraw from it, which is kind of hilarious considering the fact that, one, that doesn't stop every other country who was part of the Paris Accord from trying
still
to reach
just
those,
standing
goals.
By those goals.
And
yeah,
two, most corporations in America who were affected by that climate accord know that likely once he's out of office, we're going to rejoin it, mm-hmm, assuming a Democrat isn't president and Democrats have political control. So they're just going to abide by it anyways. And you're only going to have, you know, a handful of corporations who decide to go full grifter and, you know, go backwards in time and erase all of the progress that they were forced to make,
yeah,
because of Obama era rules and the Paris Accord.
I mean, you had a lot of local municipalities and state governments who have all just said, "We're going to stick with the Paris Climate Accord."
Yeah.
And like you said, a lot of corporations who want to do business internationally, if they don't obey the Paris Climate Accord internationally, where governments have co-opted to, you know, set down some guidelines and some rules about emissions and whatnot,
yeah,
and they just stick with the U.S. regulations and rules, they're not going to be able to easily do business. And I mean, that's what you see a lot of things where the EU has passed certain laws and even corporations who predominantly do business in the States basically adopt them too, because it's just impossible to,
yeah,
to run two platforms with two sets of laws and all.
Yeah,
this.
It's a hassle for them to follow. And, you know, as long as they can do business in the EU sphere, you know, they stand to make money. So, I mean,
yeah.
And this is what's kind of baffling about it, is that corporations stand to make money if they actually transition into renewable energy. You know, they can use,
yeah,
their pre-existing, you know, market shares to sort of capitalize on that.
I think there's a lot of closed-mindedness in terms of companies and the profits that are to be made. You know, it's easy to realize profits that are right in front of you.
Right.
And hard to, I think, understand that the long-term goal there would be more beneficial to them if they stuck towards a more renewable source of energy,
right,
and more profitable to them. But And I think you're starting to see that. You're starting to see a lot more electronic or electric cars coming on the market.
Yeah, and you're just seeing car companies making more alternatives. So that way you don't hear of, you know, Priuses and Teslas. You know, those are the two things that come to mind when you say electric car.
Electric cars.
You know, there's Nissans, there's Fords, and I think there's even like a Kia. I don't know what, you know, brand or car company owns.
I mean,
that.
The electric market, it's really getting huge. And that's just because it's profitable and that's what people want.
Yeah, now there's a Chinese car maker that's going to be the first Chinese car manufacturer to challenge Tesla in the U.S. BMW is coming out with their own electric car. Yeah, there's electric Hyundais. I mean, electric cars are starting to become the norm because technology has given us the ability to have them and sometimes they even drive themselves, which is kind of cool.
I mean, and electric cars are nothing new. The concept dates back to, you know, the turn of the century with the gasoline engine. I believe it was actually first an electric car.
Or maybe even like steam.
Yeah, steam. And I think
that was more like boats. But,
you know, and it's just, I think, a concept where at the moment it's easy to do technologically.
If you have the capital, you can do it.
But I also think that there was a time period, maybe like 30 or 40 years ago, where a lot of car companies actively suppressed that market
and research on it too
and prevented people from acting on that
that's kind of bringing it full circle. When Rex mentioned the Paris Climate Accord, immediately after Donald Trump pulled the entire country out of it, you had governors from the following states create their own climate alliance where they not only wanted to uphold the standards set forth by the Paris Climate Accord but arguably wanted to go farther. So we have California, Colorado, Connecticut, Delaware, Hawaii, Maryland, Massachusetts, Minnesota, New Jersey, New York, North Carolina, Oregon, Puerto Rico, Rhode Island, Vermont, Virginia, and Washington State. So that's for a 17 governors, and arguably with as many governorships as Democrats just won in the midterms, you might see more states joining the ranks there. But it seems like the old states' rights argument that Republicans throw around constantly is
convenient when they like it.
Yeah, and now the states are deciding to exercise their rights to live in an environment that won't murder them.
Well, that's an interesting point you bring up, because recently there was some fights in regards to California and the EPA regulations that they had put on, you know, what's permissible in terms of emissions, I think, on their cars. And Trump and Republicans were trying to come
roll
down
back the rules.
Yeah, they're trying to roll back the rules, and California said, "No, we have, you know, rules here, and we've determined these, and we have the ability to do that." And then it kind of became this fight over the state's rights in terms of, we want to protect our state and we want to hold ourselves to these rules. And then the federal government saying, no, you can't do that. And it's like, well, then
that's the whole point of states' rights. You know, there's state sovereignty where they can dictate, you know, if they want to go farther than what the federal government dictates, then they can. And they have,
which was literally just what was happening. Yeah.
Right. And you know, I mean, the other shocking component of that is you had the federal government saying, we want to go backwards in time. Let us do that. You know, let's erase progress. You want to erase progress because we tell you to.
Yeah. And I mean, I don't know what it is. If it's just a lot of pandering to a base who's uneducated and is behind, you know,
behind the times
and use coal and gas.
I mean, how much are they even really paying attention to that?
West Virginia, for instance.
Right. I mean, that makes sense.
A lot of their economy, I guess, is kind of rooted in coal mining.
Right.
And one of Trump's big campaign things was
clean
coal.
Which is an oxymoron because clean coal doesn't exist.
Absolutely ridiculous.
The process of burning coal is a very dirty process that is not good for the environment. And that's just scientific fact.
It's also extremely dangerous to remove from the ground for the workers and
coal lung. That's good old
black lung. Yeah.
Disease.
I mean, it's like, not only is
it's
it
health and safety
physically
hazard.
Dangerous, you could have a mine shaft collapse, but you could also develop a lot of horrible
lung
diseases,
respiratory issues, and die because of it.
And I mean, it's their economy. I get it. You know, that's why they rally behind clean coal, is because that's what a lot of the jobs are based off of. But in reality is, if you can make a transition from clean coal to another renewable source that's actually beneficial for the environment, and like I was saying, has more incentive to be produced because it's just has its chance to make more money,
right?
You can transition that economy pretty easily.
And there's a lot of jobs there too for those folks. I mean, not necessarily all of them are going to be of the qualifications or, you know, I guess pedigree, for lack of a better term. You know, they're not, you know, trained in the field of renewable energy or
right.
electrics or anything like that. They might not have the prerequisite knowledge or qualifications to do that. But that's a lot of what someone like Hillary Clinton was incorporating into her 2016 platform was, you know, unfortunately, with the future the way it is between climate change and, you know, automation, a lot of those people are losing their jobs. We want to. Well, evidently that's what the 60 million Americans thought when they voted for Donald Trump.
Yeah.
But, you know, that was her whole plan, right? Was to try and provide these people a different kind of opportunity to train them in other areas and to make sure that by virtue of transitioning to renewable energy to save the environment, we weren't ripping out the rugs from hundreds yeah. of thousands of people.
But I think there was a knee-jerk reaction to that, and she caught a lot of flack during her campaign when she talked about these issues.
Yeah, because she was, what, like ignoring coal country, or she
exactly, yeah.
over
I
it.
Mean, the idea is coal is not the future here, and what we really need to be doing is transitioning your economy into a market that's going to be more sustainable for the future.
Yeah.
Whether or not that's, you know, like you said, battery factories or, you know, maybe
electric
manufacturing.
Car production plants.
Yeah, exactly. Solar panels or
yeah, wind farms.
Something completely different, maybe not even energy related, but the fact of the matter stands is that economy is going to collapse in the next 10 years or 20 years because no one is going to be buying and burning coal.
Yeah.
And if they are, I think they'll be in the minority because I'm hopeful that things are making a transition.
Oh yeah. And I think they are. I remember seeing a couple of days ago, there was an international climate conference, or I think it was a climate and energy. I think it was more actually focused on the energy because there was a U.S. representative there trying to push coal as a viable source of energy
yeah,
to other countries. And that U.S. representative was literally
laughed
out of the room.
Yeah. They were there at this climate, you know,
energy conference
convention or what have you. And they were, I believe that the United States was the only country there that was not accepting the idea of climate change. And yeah, they were laughed at because they should be.
And yeah, that's climate change denialism deserves nothing short of derision and mockery.
Yeah.
Even whether it's a U.S. representative being laughed out of the international community or you laughing at your crazy Uncle Bob at Christmas dinner,
mm-hmm.
you know, the fact of the matter is this kind of viewpoint is not only not backed in any sort of fact or reality because the scientific community has deemed otherwise, but realistically, it doesn't make sense to be a climate change denier to push things like clean coal and to do that. None of it has any basis in reality.
The other thing to say about that is not only is it, it's just a foolish viewpoint to hold, but it's also something you should pity those individuals because in reality is that they're biting hook, line, and sinker into something that's false
yeah.
that's going to eventually hurt them.
Yeah.
You know, and it's kind of sad in a lot of ways too. It's not just funny. It's just kind of depressing. And mm-hmm. we're seeing a lot of, you know, harm done to the environment and to our world. You know, I mean, as far as we know, there's no other place like Earth, and
yeah.
you know, we can't just hop on a spaceship and
yeah,
take
get off this rock and onto a new one.
And you know, what we're doing is we're just using all of our resources available to us at an exponential rate. And if you believe that that's a good thing and that's helpful to the environment, then not only is it just kind of
straight up wrong,
it's sad, you know, for those people. And
yeah,
I don't know, it's definitely, I think an economic topic, it's a political topic. It's just this kind of swirling mix
maelstrom, yeah.
of issues that kind of culminate in what I ultimately believe is people denying it because they've been told by, you know, large political entities that it's not true.
Yeah. And yeah, people who deny it are victims, I think, of the
in
propaganda
some ways, yeah.
that not propaganda, that politicians and, you know, like you said, and corporations have jointly been pushing.
They've been peddling it because they stand a profit
yes.
from their operations
yeah.
as they are.
Right. So, I mean, I think to wrap this up, let's maybe talk about what we, the individual, can do to combat this and to fight this.
Mm-hmm.
I think the biggest thing that's recommended as far as, you know, reducing your own emissions
is to ride lime scooters. everywhere.
Different forms of transportation. You know, if you can take public transportation, carpool, subways, things like that. As far as what you consume, eating less red meat specifically.
Yeah, one of the larger contributing factors to...
is farming.
Climate change is farming, yeah. A lot of the feedlots, you know, from the cows. I mean, you just think about it. Cows eat, cows fart.
Yeah, there's a lot of methane into the atmosphere.
And then there's all the other associated processes involved with that.
Yeah.
With, you know, transporting their feed, with butchering them, with transporting the beef. And
right.
In terms of the calories that you get out of red meat versus the amount of energy that goes in, there's something like, I think, only, you know, 12% efficient at converting, you know, calories from plants into, you know, calories. Marcus, this is going to look this up for me, but yeah, it's just incredibly inefficient. I happen to eat meat, but another thing to just take into account is just cut back a little bit on it, and that's one thing you can do.
Yeah, and I think a lot of people would also recommend just less meat in general, because, you know, farming,
it's not as healthy in a lot of ways.
Right, but I know at the very least, sticking to not red meat, you know, as long as it's not coming from a cow, or, you know, probably omitting pork too wouldn't hurt, because pigs are not as big of a contributor, but they're contributing to the, you know, the farming practices and everything. I think chickens aren't as big of a strain, but I mean, again, a lot of people just recommend abstaining from meat absolutely, just for the sake of the environment, not even taking into account
there's a lot of moral issues and whatnot in regards to that. Vegetarianism is definitely you know, I think that in terms of that dietary style, it serves a lot of purpose.
Yeah, so here's a nice breakdown from University of Vermont researchers about energy inputs per food calorie for several classes of food. And then for meat, a lot of the energy input per calorie, I think it's 40%-ish, looks like it's all in production, and then another like 20% in processing, and then the rest in distribution.
But just in terms of the raw breakdown, is like if you were to eat a pound of grain versus a pound of beef, like the amount of starting calories that would go in to produce that pound of beef is an outrageous amount.
Oh, yeah.
Just the laws of thermodynamics.
Exactly. I mean, just energy going in and energy coming out. Yeah. A lot going in and not a lot coming back to you in terms of nutrition and sustenance. But yeah, as far as, again, what we can do, public transportation, modifying how you get back and forth to either work or other destinations
you go to. You can walk.
I walk back and forth constantly. Yeah. I have a bike. I think really the biggest thing, and this is what a lot of reports have been backing up recently, is that the biggest contributors to climate change are large corporations. And like you alluded to earlier, the solution to that are things like carbon taxes and increased government regulation. And to make that happen, we the people need to put people in Washington, D.C.
in charge that can make
that have the ability to
fit that,
to get that regulation hopefully established, to try and rein in some of these corporations from trashing the environment in exchange for bigger wallets.
Yeah, I mean, and there's not a whole lot you can do internationally, but I mean, I know that one of the larger contributing factors to climate change is concrete. It puts off a massive amount of CO2.
I believe it.
And China is going through a very rapid industrialization right now.
Yeah.
And in the last year, they poured more concrete that was poured in the entire industrial revolution in the United States.
That's ridiculous.
And yeah, I don't really know what the solution is there, but
I mean, that's a matter of foreign policy, right?
It's
how we approach negotiating with China, right? Yeah. You know, we want to continue a trade relationship, but we want that to be one of shared concern for the future of the planet. And we would need a strong and effective leader that's the polar opposite of what we've got going on right now to make that happen. So that way we
somebody who's not a very stable genius.
Yeah, we need a very unstable idiot.
Very unstable idiot.
Because a very stable genius is not doing us any favors right now.
Okay. I could bite into that, yeah. And maybe somebody who wouldn't lobby massive tariffs on goods that aren't really helping the economy, but yeah.
You know, that's neither here nor there.
Water under the bridge.
Water under the bridge that's evaporating. There won't be a river running under the bridge anymore.
Or rising, so you no longer have a bridge.
The bridge will be underwater.
Yeah.
It could go either way, depending on where it is.
Yeah, exactly, which is a big foundation to the climate change myths.
Winter is coming.
I found that button, too. But yeah, I think with that, I mean, that's a pretty a general sort of overview. One, you know, the scientific community agrees it's a problem. Anybody arguing otherwise, I think, is willfully ignorant at this point.
Mm-hmm.
Two, we don't have people in Washington to support it. And three, both on the personal level and on the policy level, us, the people, can do something about it. And I think a lot of the, even though our listeners are primarily here in Oregon, which is a blue state that wants to do something about it, you either know people in different states who are residents of different states, or you can hold your current set of Congress critters accountable and make sure that they actually do follow through on their promises to address climate change and get more of them in office.
I mean,
keep them there.
Arguably has a beneficial economic impact. It has a benefit to where you live. I mean, obviously you want to be able to breathe clean air.
And
you
want
to be
water.
Able to drink clean water. You want to wake up and enjoy that great outdoors and not just burn up because it's, 25 degrees plus from what it would be normally on the average.
Yeah. But do you know how I react when I drink clean water and breathe clean air?
How is that?
Hoo-wee!
Mr. Meek Seeks from Rick and Morty. That wasn't as loud as I hope it was.
These are all things that I think, whether or not you identify with the issue one way or another, you could just agree that those are subjectively good.
Anyone arguing against clean water and clean air is not to be taken seriously.
Yeah. Do you want clean water? No.
I might be in trouble on that one.
Yeah. I mean, you would be in trouble in that case.
Yeah. But anyways, I think that'll probably do it for us, because we've been going between the last episode and this one for at least 3 hours.
Yeah, 3 hours and 45 minutes, give or take.
Yeah. Oh, God, we're getting close to four. All right, that's probably our cue to wrap it up and let you lovely folks who have been tortured by us talking politics for the last 4 hours get back to music.
Yeah, well, thanks for listening to Alternative Lies live. And
because I still can't get into the podcast studio.
Joined by my great co-host here, Marcus, and I'm Rex. So thanks for listening. Appreciate it.
See you on the next one.